Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who discusses the armed rebellion attempting to overthrow the government of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Karen Wayland, Acting Legislative Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who examines the winners and losers in a new incarnation of last year's defeated energy bill now before Congress. And Dr. Kurt Gottfried, Chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who explains why leading scientists have signed a statement condemning the Bush administration for suppressing and distorting scientific fact in pursuit of its political agenda. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that a confidential United Nations document on the Democratic Republic of the Congo accuses Rwanda and Uganda of arming militia armies in the Congo to control rich diamond and gold mines. One of the most explosive charges in the report is that Congo opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi, who recently returned after 2 years in exile in South Africa, is organising a new armed revolt with the aid of Rwandan forces. The former exile's political party, the Union of Democracy and Social Progress, refused to join Congo's transitional government last June, and weeks later his 3,000-member militia was already in training. Overall, the UN report concludes that the Rwandan forces are the biggest threat to Congo's stability and to President Joseph Kabila. The UN charges Rwanda with arming and training several militia units. In addition, the report also provides documents on how money for arms was raised with mineral sales from mines owned by the Congo Holding Development Company, based in Goma, next to the Rwandan border. Meanwhile, the 10,000-strong UN peacekeeping force in the Congo is struggling to bring calm to the troubled nation. On a recent trip, UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan complained of a vicious cycle of lawlessness in the Congo and ongoing massive human rights abuses. The Financial Times reports that United Nations investigators in East Timor are making a new push to have former General Wiranto, the one-time Indonesian defence minister and a current presidential candidate, placed under arrest. General Wiranto was indicted by the UN in February 2003, but remains free because an Indonesian court has not sought his arrest. The general is accused of masterminding the violence after the 1999 East Timor vote in favour of self-determination. The legal move against Wiranto has complicated the general's plans to win the endorsement of the Golkar Party, the group loyal to former dictator Suharto. To win the nomination, Wiranto faces party head Akbar Tanjung, who was cleared by the Indonesian Supreme Court of corruption charges. If the general can win the Golkar nod and beat current president Megawati Sukarnoputri in July elections, it could put the United States in a difficult position. Currently, General Wiranto is on the State Department watch list that requires a special permit to enter the United States. The question is, would Wiranto remain on the watch list if he is elected Indonesia's president? Long-time Indonesia watcher Sidney Jones of the International Crisis Group does not think that the human rights charges against General Wiranto, if elected president, would make any difference to the White House. The American Prospect magazine reports that the Bush-Cheney re-election campaign has been in high gear for months. Flush with over $130 million in campaign cash, the Bush team has put key staff into 24 states and is training state and local Republican operatives to boost GOP voter registration and mobilization. While Bush is looking to push an inclusive mainstream message, emails are sent out regularly to keep the party's right-wing base primed for the November election. Recently, the re-election campaign put an attack ad against John Kerry on its internet site. In December, the target was George Soros, who has given millions to pro-democratic groups such as MoveOn.org. In the battleground state of Florida, the GOP is working to register 75,000 new voters. Local coordinators are already in place in all of Florida's 67 counties. Republicans are also hard at work to repress core Democratic voters. In last fall's combative mayoral race in Philadelphia, 300 GOP activists drove around the city in cars with insignias similar to the Drug Enforcement Administration or to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms in African-American neighbourhoods. According to a Democratic consultant, these activists in uniform ask potential voters for identification. In a post-election poll, 7% of Philadelphia's black voters said they encountered these voter intimidation tactics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
As armed rebels seized Haiti's second-largest city, Cap-Haïtien, consolidating their control over the northern half of the country, food supplies have been looted and paramilitary gangs hunted down loyalists of embattled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Meanwhile, American, French, and Organization of American States diplomats attempted to convince opposition groups to accept a peace plan, already agreed to by President Aristide, that would institute a power-sharing arrangement and plan for new legislative elections. In the capital of Port-au-Prince, supporters of President Aristide built barricades and patrolled city streets to repel an expected rebel attack there. Haiti's small and ill-equipped police force is no match for the heavily armed rebels, many of whom are former members of Haiti's disbanded army. Rebel leaders Louis-Jodel Chamblain and Guy Philippe are both associated with FRAP, a death squad accused of murdering, raping, and torturing thousands of Haitians after the military overthrew Aristide's first government in 1991. Critics charge that opposition groups calling for Aristide's ouster have been funded by the Bush administration through the National Endowment for Democracy, long used by Washington to funnel support to allies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Larry Burns, executive director with the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Burns discusses U.S. policy and the need for international intervention to prevent the establishment of another military dictatorship in Haiti, a nation which has suffered through dozens of coups and revolts over the past 200 years.
I feel that the Bush administration has seriously miscalculated as to what its move should be. It has merely carried out the policy that was authored under the Clinton administration, which was one of malign neglect regarding President Aristide. There's been ongoing hostility, and worse, on the part of Washington towards Aristide, who Washington has looked upon as a rabble-rouser, as someone who would introduce a radicalized social program if given the opportunity. So it has been Washington's long mission to engender a policy of power sharing, which it first attempted to press on Aristide in the early 90s at the Governor's Island Conference, which Aristide resisted, and more recently in a meeting, a special high-level mission from the United States and Canada, CARICOM countries, as well as France, went into Haiti, and they met with Haitian officials and called for power sharing, which Aristide reluctantly accepted, but which the opposition refuses to do so. The policy of the opposition up to this point has been to subscribe to a zero-option approach, which would mean no negotiations with the Aristide government. Simply, the opposition would lay down the diktat that Aristide must step down as an essential first step to any solution. And that was the point. The point was reached where Aristide had accepted every proposal that had come forth from the CARICOM countries, from the OAS, from the United States, and from the Bishops' Conference of Haiti, all calling for a specific list of concessions on Aristide's part. Unfortunately, the opposition, known as the nonviolent opposition, which is rapidly merging with the violent opposition, the opposition was non-responsive, and the State Department was still pressing the opposition to accept a power-sharing arrangement, but the opposition still refused to do so.
Larry Burns, what do you foresee happening in the coming days? Is it possible that Secretary of State Colin Powell, concerned with the upcoming presidential election and the very delicate issue of Haitian refugees pouring into a key state in that election in Florida, would work with Caribbean nations or the French to have some kind of force go in to protect Aristide's government in Port-au-Prince and then try and broker a deal that, in all likelihood, would marginalize President Aristide?
The U.S. foreign policy, its main goal in Haiti is to prevent Haitians from coming to Florida. That's perfectly clear. U.S. policy, on the other hand, once implemented, has done everything possible to accelerate Haitians to try to come to Florida because they almost have no other option than to make that perilous 700-mile trip in which their usual fate will be either to drown or to be interdicted and to be returned right where they began, in Haiti. With so many postmortems being done on why the UN and why the U.S. didn't go into Rwanda, other parts of the world, in Serbia, where massacres were occurring, I cannot easily envisage that the United States is going to risk being labeled as being indifferent to this country at such a perilous moment in its history. I think Washington also has to consider its present very troubled relations with the rest of Latin America, which probably have never been worse in my memory than they are right now. That is, the United States has alienated a whole generation of Latin American leaders by this bizarre team of foreign policy advisors, you know, led by people like Otto Reich and Roger Noriega, who are totally inappropriate and totally unable to field a traditional foreign policy that is not driven by an obsession over Fidel Castro.
What is at stake for the people of Haiti in the coming days and for the United States and U.S. policy? And what would you urge citizens to do in terms of being proactive on doing what they can to preserve democracy in Haiti?
I would really like to see the Congressional Black Caucus join with Representative Maxine Waters of California and really speak out on this issue. Whether Aristide is going to be able to muster sufficient forces from basically street gangs at this point, because he doesn't have enough police left, even if they were willing to risk their lives, and not any number of them have lost their lives already by putting up a defense which just hasn't worked. It hasn't worked because most of them are untrained. As for the repercussions on the Haitian population, can anything be worse than what they are now suffering, basically eating ground dirt as the major dish? What we have now is Colin Powell has to realize that, in spite of Aristide's many personal failings, that he has been a democratic asset, perhaps the most valuable asset in the country, since he originally was the only person who could and did get the Haitians to terribly sacrifice from 91 to 94 during the period of military regime, where the Haitians would almost ask for the whip if the lash of the whip would also hit members of the military.
That was Larry Burns, Executive Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Contact the Council by calling area code 202-216-9261 or visit their website at www.coha.org. Last November, the Senate defeated a mammoth energy bill that would have increased U.S. reliance on oil, natural gas, coal, and nuclear power while throwing crumbs to promote renewable energy and conservation. In addition to the active opposition of environmental groups, what killed the bill in the end was the insistence of some legislative leaders that the measure provide protection from lawsuits filed against makers of MTBE, a toxic gasoline additive demonstrated to have contaminated groundwater across the country. The bill has been introduced in Congress again by Senator Pete Domenici, Republican of New Mexico. This time, the Senate version omits the liability protection for MTBE, but House Majority Leader Tom DeLay says that makes the bill a non-starter in the House of Representatives. DeLay's district is home to companies that produce MTBE. Other features of the bill include big tax breaks for the oil industry and expensive taxpayer-funded offshore drilling incentives, such as the proposed giveaway of undersea oil to energy companies in environmentally fragile Alaskan areas. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Karen Wayland, acting legislative director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. She examines who stands to win and lose in this new incarnation of the energy bill.
The MTBE provision was one of the issues that caused senators to try to block the bill the last time it came before the Senate. Senator Domenici removed that provision, but he only removed one of the provisions that dealt with MTBE. The one he removed would have given a free pass to MTBE producers from the cleanup costs associated with groundwater contamination from MTBE. We fully expect that provision will be added in when the bill goes to the House because Tom DeLay from Texas has been adamant that no energy bill will get through the House without that provision being in the energy bill. So that is something that we expect to see rearing its ugly head again if the Senate bill passes.
I know that drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was taken out of the bill last year, but has it been put back in?
It's not in the Senate version that Senator Domenici just introduced again, and the reason is that he doesn't have the votes in the Senate to pass it. But on the House side, they are vowing to put that drilling provision right back in again. This bill is bad right now. If it leaves the Senate, it's only going to get worse.
Are there any major changes in the amount of dollars that this bill would cost compared to the one that was defeated last year?
Yes, but those changes are really smoke and mirror changes. They changed the effective date of some of the tax incentives. They just delayed them by a year. We all know that these tax incentives are not going to go away. Some of these tax incentives have been continually renewed for year after year after year. So he's really just playing around with effective dates to try to make the cost of the bill look less than it is. And in fact, one thing that Senator Domenici did, which is really ironic, is that in order to make the cost of the bill look less, he cut this very popular energy savings performance contracting program, which allows federal agencies to reduce their energy costs by adopting energy efficiency measures. And he deleted that because it requires an initial capital outlay to install some energy efficient appliances or to put new windows in. But this program has been highly popular because it's been guaranteed to save taxpayers millions and millions of dollars over the long term. And so this clearly shows that this energy bill is not about conservation, about energy efficiency, about renewable energy, about clean energy. This is all about business as usual.
And what are opponents focusing on?
Well, we're raising the issues that we raised the last time this bill was around, that this bill is not going to secure America's energy independence by reducing our dependence on foreign oil. This bill continues to subsidize corporate polluters. It gives billions of our tax dollars to the coal, nuclear, oil, and gas industries instead of investing in clean, affordable, energy-saving technologies that we need, and those are not in this bill right now. The bill threatens our public health by weakening the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. There are provisions in the bill that would promote accelerated oil and gas development in our public lands and in our coasts. This bill was terrible in November, which is why the Senate stopped it, and it's still terrible.
Is there a coalition that's come together to oppose this bill?
We have a very active coalition, and we've been, you know, this is an issue that we've been working on for the last 3 years at least on federal energy legislation. And so it's a smooth-running coalition, so to speak. It's a number of at least 15 different environmental organizations and public health organizations, taxpayers organizations, and a number of unions have come out in opposition of the bill.
I know that there's opposition, bipartisan opposition to the bill in the Senate, including Republicans such as John McCain and many of the more moderate Republican senators from New England. But what is the game plan?
Our first line of defense is to filibuster the bill. And our goal is to keep that bill from leaving the Senate. Because, again, once it leaves the Senate, the House has vowed to make it worse, and we just don't want that to happen.
How does this bill play into presidential politics?
This energy policy was one of the priorities of the Bush administration. And you remember, this energy bill was born in secrecy in the Bush-Cheney Energy Task Force. It came to the Senate and was negotiated in secret in conference and came out basically following the lines of what the Bush-Cheney Energy Task Force laid out. So I think that the Bush administration has a huge stake in seeing this energy bill passed. And there are a number of Democratic senators who were running for presidency who've laid out alternatives and who have opposed the energy bill that we're currently looking at right now.
That was Karen Wayland of the Natural Resources Defense Council. For more information on the energy bill, call the NRDC at area code 202-513-6241 or visit their website at www.nrdc.org. In a statement signed by more than 60 prominent scientists, including 20 Nobel laureates, leading medical experts, former heads of government agencies, and presidents of universities condemned the Bush administration for suppressing and distorting scientific analysis and taking actions which have undermined the quality of scientific advisory panels. Russell Train, who served as head of the Environmental Protection Agency under Republican presidents Nixon and Ford, was among those endorsing the statement. The declaration and an accompanying report titled Scientific Integrity in Policymaking was issued by the Union of Concerned Scientists on February 18th. The signers of the statement maintain that the administration has employed censorship and manipulated data in areas such as air pollution, climate change, and the control of toxic substances in pursuit of partisan political gain. Allegations that scientists working at several federal agencies have been subjected to political interference in their research are examined in the report. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Kurt Gottfried, Emeritus Professor of Physics at Cornell University and Chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists Board of Directors. Dr. Gottfried summarizes the scientists' critique of the White House handling of scientific issues and their call for congressional hearings to investigate their charges.
There's been a mounting alarm over stretching back now a couple of years about the way the administration interacts with science. This is not an alarm about the way it funds science. That is not an issue that we address at all. It is not really even about the policies that they espouse and want to get through legislation and so forth. The alarm is that the administration distorts the process by which it feeds scientific knowledge and information into its decision-making. And secondly, that it distorts and misrepresents the science that surrounds its policies. So, for example, take the case of climate change, which is, in a way, the most serious case because of its long-term impact. I mean, the president ran on a platform which opposed mandatory restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, he was elected on that. So that's not what we're not really complaining about his opposition to climate change policies. What we're complaining about is that they distort the picture. First, the most important and well-known example actually is that when the Environmental Protection Agency last spring was about to issue a major report on the environment, which had a chapter on climate change, the White House tried to order the EPA to change that chapter on climate change by deleting a graph that shows the temperature record over the last 1,000 years, by removing a reference to a National Academy study that the president himself had ordered, changing the wording so that it now implies that cooling is as likely as warming. And what finally happened is that the EPA staff decided it was not going to publish this chapter at all because they didn't want to defend a scientifically indefensible document.
Dr. Gottfried, is the actions that the Bush administration are taking around science comparable to things that you've seen in other presidential administrations in the last decades?
No, it's our contention then. And one of the basic things we're saying, that this is an unprecedented to our recollection, and, you know, we're not a young outfit, I regret to say. I would guess that the average age of the signers that I know is over 60. So they've seen a lot of administrations and a lot of interactions between administrations over a long period of time, and we are saying this is unprecedented in extent. and intensity. There are individual cases in other administrations of both parties. They are not free of this, but it's never been seen at this level. People cannot recall candidates or nominees for advisory committees, for example, being asked about their political views, and in some instances, there's even documented ones in our report, where they were asked who they voted for in the last election. That I had not heard before.
Well, given it's an election year, what would you like to see happen here with this report and your specific charges made against the Bush administration? What outcome would you want to see happen here?
Well, I think the first thing that should happen, in a way, is for Congress to have a look at this. We're limited, really, in the end, to how much we can investigate this situation. We've done the best job we could. Much of what we have to say has been in newspapers all over the place, and we've put it together. We've done some investigation that goes beyond that. We have interviewed a fair number of people inside the government, but they, of course, can't give their names, so the report has to say this is by an anonymous source. Congress could really look into this, get a much better feel for what really the story is in full detail. One thing that we're quite concerned about is the morale of outstanding institutions like the National Institute of Health. The National Institute of Health is one of the great scientific institutions in the world. The scientists that work there, the top people, can find employment elsewhere. You know, it took decades to produce the high quality of an institution like the Center for Disease Control or the National Institute of Health, but it can be destroyed quite quickly. So I think what's really important would be for Congress to have a serious look at this and see to it that it passes legislation and regulations that make some of these activities that we're concerned with illegal or at least difficult to pursue. You know, I've come to think that this is not just a problem for this administration. If it becomes possible to do the sort of things we complain about and has become possible, there's no guarantee that won't continue in another administration of a different party. And any decision maker likes to get information that confirms an opinion he already had. Therefore, you need a fence, so to say, or restrictions, which don't make it so easy for pre-cooked decisions to be confirmed by scientific data. And if we don't repair that situation, it might become permanent.
That was Dr. Kurt Gottfried, chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. To obtain a copy of the group's statement and report, contact the Union of Concerned Scientists at area code 617-547-5552 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Prue Cullen, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.